Hello everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics. I'm Andrew, and as per usual, I'm joined by my co-host Rob.
Hello!
And Mick.
Hello!
So, how are we all doing today?
Just fine and dandy, I think.
Fed. I've been fed.
Oh, I hope it wasn't after midnight.
Technically yes, and technically no. I was always confused by that don't feed him after midnight bit, because I'm like, well, hang on. Does that mean don't feed him at all during the next day?
But it's always the next day somewhere.
Exactly.
Okay, I'm glad I'm not the only one that was just sat there going, but when can you start feeding them?
Exactly. So, yeah.
I would assume probably sunrise. But anyway, since we're speaking about strange creatures that primarily stick to the nighttime in their habits, Batman.
Effortless segue there.
Yeah, I like effortless. It. I like it.
God, it's like we haven't taken a week off at all.
No, nominate him for segue of the year.
So this week's topic is Batman, specifically alternate versions.
Okay, before we get into this, can I ask a question? Are we talking about the alternate versions who are canon or the non-canon version?
Technically, both. I figured we could start off talking about people who have replaced Bruce Wayne as Batman
right.
In the main DC continuity.
Yes.
And then maybe move on to some alternate universes.
Okay, right.
Oh, I see. This is the latest episode in your special series of How to Make Mick's Brain Hurt.
Yes. Yes, it is.
All right, okay.
So we are going to kick things off with probably the most famous Batman replacement, John Paul Valley.
Oh, Azrael.
Yep, Azrael. This is a character introduced in the 90s Batman comics. He was an assassin trained by the Order of Saint-Dumas until Batman rescued him, kind of deprogrammed him, and started training him as his replacement. You know, should there ever come an occasion where Bruce Wayne could no longer fulfill his Batmanly duties?
See, I always liked the mini-series that introduced Azrael. The Sword of Azrael series was an interesting one, but then they did Nightfall, and then it just went on and on and on, and then I can't remember what they did. It wasn't Nightquest. Nightquest came afterwards. It was Nightfall all the way through, and then you had Jean-Paul Valley becoming Batman, which was, oh, that was just bizarre.
Yep. So to cycle back, for people who don't know, Nightfall is the rather famous storyline where Bane is first introduced, and this is not the version who is Tom Hardy with some kind of weird sex toy on his face. this is big luchador Bane, who basically just grabs Batman, snaps his back, and yeah, breaks the bat, as he says.
What I loved about the Nightfall series up to that point was that it was very methodical. Bane did things from the shadows. He never introduced himself. He never stood in front of Batman. The first thing he did was break every major criminal, all of Batman's major foes, out of Arkham. He did like a mass prisoner release from Arkham, and the city was being ripped apart. So Batman, over the course of days and weeks, was constantly out every night, night after night, trying to catch these criminals and put them back in prison. And he basically wore himself down to the point where Bane just walked in, because he'd already figured out who Batman was, walked into Wayne Manor, beat the crap out of him and broke his back. I thought, that's kind of brutal, and I like it.
Yeah,
but
I do like that certainly more recently, the comics and kind of movies and TV and stuff, I've remembered that Bane is actually smart.
Yeah, he's smart. He's basically the evil version of Banner Hulk without the physics degree. But
Remember Batman and Robin?
Yes. I hate that version of Bane, you know this. But
I know it's shocking to consider that maybe one of the characters in that film was not an entirely accurate and well-thought-out portrayal, but there it is.
But who knew it was one of the villains?
Exactly. But the weird thing is, they did Nightfall. It was bizarre because Nightfall came about because of the death of Superman.
Yeah, exactly. It was trying to capitalize on that. Let's, you know, shake up the status quo, get rid of our hero, have him be replaced by someone completely new.
and then bring him back again.
Exactly. Although, so as you may have gathered from Rob's non-complimentary nature, Azrael as Batman was not well received.
Oh, God, no. I mean, first, it wasn't well received by Dick Grayson, who everybody thought Dick Grayson was going to inherit the mantle of Batman, because that's basically what he's there for.
Yeah, Dick Grayson is basically the guy at the start of the Indeed advert who's been passed up for promotion once again.
Yes. That's exactly him. I mean, it went through, like, I think most of the characters in the Batman side of DC's universe looked at it and went, what? You chose him over Dick Grayson? Can you imagine the Batman villains going, is he okay? Does he need to see somebody? Has he hit his head a bit too hard? He chose this guy who he just met over this guy who he trained for most of his life.
So, like, because it's basically just the Batman equivalent of the Anvil joke from Arrested Development.
Yes, it is. Yes, just it is.
Him?
And that was literally all of our reactions when it was revealed that Jean-Paul Valley was going to take over as Batman. I was talking to some of my friends about it, and they went, I don't understand what DC are doing. It doesn't make sense. Dick Grayson is Batman. He should be Batman. Why isn't he Batman? And at this time, we didn't have email, so we had to write letters to DC.
On vellum, with quills.
Yes, Peter Quills.
Still, if there is one complimentary thing we can all agree on, it's that the Azrael version of Batman has the best bat costume.
No, he doesn't.
No, he doesn't. That's a lie.
The best bat costume of that type, you know, the armoured type, was the one in Batman vs. Predator, the first Batman vs. Predator.
Yeah. See, that's a good design. This one, it's got a lot going on.
Doesn't he have an armoured codpiece, like the characters in the Stallone Judge Dredd movie?
No, no. Strangely, the codpiece is like, oh, wait, or is that? No, no. The codpiece is the one region that is not ludicrously heavily armoured.
I know it was a lot spikier than...
Yeah, he's got leg spikes, which are just quite confusing. He's got the essential 90s, like, bandolier of pouches.
Oh, God, yeah,
one forgot. Of his thighs.
Yeah, doesn't he have, like, the garter pouch thing?
Yeah.
Oh, and what were those things that were sticking out the side of his, you know, his calves? Were they supposed to be bat wings, or were they supposed to be, like... Because they looked kind of dangerous, and I was worried about the Batmobile if he sat in it a bit too wrong.
Yeah, it's one of those things where they just have absolutely no earthly purpose whatsoever. But the weird thing about this version of Batman is there's a lot of conflicting reports on, like, how much of this was deliberate. Because it seems like there's kind of a big disconnect between editorial, who maybe, like, did actually want this to be a long-running storyline, where, like, this guy is the new Batman, versus writer Denny O'Neill, who basically wrote him, like, as a villain. Like, he basically had Azrael go off the deep end a bit and start murdering criminals. And so Dick Grayson take him down. And it's kind of, it's unclear which of... And also even with the design, or was it, like, to be, like, a parody of over the 90s edgy kind? Because he does have so many edges.
God, he is the edgiest of all the edgelords from the 90s.
Edgelords?
He is a total edgelord, isn't he?
What? He's lord of all edges.
He is. One edge to rule them all. One edge to find them. One edge to bring them all.
Right, in the name of all that is holy, is an edgelord.
Someone who's edgy. More edgy than anyone else, Mick.
You know there's a special place in hell with people who mess with old people. That came out wrong.
Hey, it's okay. So did Azrael.
You see, my only exposure to again my only experience of Azrael is through the Arkham Knight games.
Okay, right. You can't blame me for laughing. Mick's doing it on his own. I have nothing to do.
Don't you start.
Anyway, shall we fast forward to the year 2009?
Yes.
So, once again, DC were looking for a way to shake up the Batman franchise. And in comes writer Grant Morrison. And he, you know, kind of walks into the meeting, slams his hands down on the table and says, "It's simple. We kill the bat." See, that's like Heath Ledger Joker, like his thing. Batman died.
So Grant Morrison's run was Batman dying?
It was Rick's, like, he died in Grant Morrison's run, and then it also died in, like, Final Crisis, the big event comic, but then maybe that Batman was a clone of something. Batman died, but then did. Anyway, some part of Batman's dead. He's gone.
Was there some weird guy with a hunter's hat wandering around DC offices going, "Kill the Batman, kill the Batman"?
See, I like Heath Ledger Joker better.
Yeah, man, so anyway, Thelma Ford.
This led to a storyline called Battle for the Cowl, where all three of the main Robins start dressing up as Batman. So you got Dick Grayson.
Whoa. All three of the main Robins. What? There are ancillary Robins?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My head hurts.
Okay, there's been four Robins, right? It was Dick Grayson, Jason Todd.
No, technically now there's been like...
Yeah. I'm talking
five
about,
and a half I'm main talking about, Robins.
I'm talking about...
Half a Robin? Yeah. That must get messy.
Yeah, I'm talking about originally, right? Originally, there was four Robins. There was Dick Grayson, Jason Todd, Tim Drake, who took over after Jason Todd, and Damian Wayne. I think there's...
those are the four big ones.
Yeah.
Then there's also a character called Stephanie Brown, who goes by Spoiler, who was sort of Robin for a bit, but then wasn't for very long.
And then there's What's-A-Face, who's Robin in The Dark Knight Returns.
Yep, that's Carrie Kelly.
Yep.
But anyway, for the purposes of this... The three important Robins are Dick Grayson, Tim Drake, and Jason Todd.
Who is dead, but not dead.
Yeah, he came back as a guy called the Red Hood. Had a few screws loose. Decided he was going to be angry murder Batman who's going to kill all the criminals. So the story ends with, you know, Dick Grayson fully taking on the Batman role, stopping Jason and becoming the new proper Batman.
Do you know?
And that lasted for, like, quite a while.
See, I liked it at that point because Dick Grayson was a very different Batman to Bruce Wayne, wasn't he?
Yeah. I also like the idea that you've got Dick Grayson as kind of the fun, lighthearted Batman.
Yeah.
With Damian Wayne, the serious, angry Robin.
Yeah, which I thought was great because it was a total change from Bruce Wayne and Tim Drake, which had lasted for a while, with Bruce Wayne being the serious, broody type and Tim Drake being the fun-loving one.
Serious Angry Robin. That's the Christmas card I want this year.
But yeah, I quite enjoyed Dick Grayson as Batman with Damian Wayne as Robin. I thought that was a good pairing, and I thought some of the storylines in there were great.
Yeah, that's a really good series, but unfortunately, it's, you know, like the old poems say, flames to dust, lovers to friends. Why must all good things come to an end?
Because someone in DC wills it so.
Probably Geoff Johns.
Because DC hadn't made enough money at that point. And so the only way to make the money is to reset. Where's the big reset button?
Exactly. Anyway, then there's also been a few other people who have temporarily been Batman in the comics. Most of them, Superman. He's subbed in for Bruce a few times.
Which has been hilarious on occasion. And he's done it in the cartoons as well.
Yeah, I think World's Finest is the comics where it like mainly happens because that was the Batman and Superman book.
Yeah.
And then the cartoons kind of took a lot of inspiration from that. And yeah, it's always the fun bit where like Batman shows up and a criminal goes to shoot him only for the bullet to just bounce off his chest.
Yeah. They're going, "He's bulletproof. Why is he bulletproof?"
Anyway, then we also had a storyline where once again Bruce Wayne was thought to be dead. And really, Jim Gordon took over.
That was a bizarre one. I didn't understand what was going on there.
Yeah, Commissioner Gordon in like a Batman mech suit.
I mean, Commissioner Gordon is like, isn't he heading for retirement? Isn't he like perpetually 2 days away from retirement?
he's never really portrayed, with the exception of yeah, he's never really portrayed as a young man, is he?
No. Can you imagine if it was the Jim Gordon from the 60s Batman in a mech suit?
Yeah. No, I think this was like the New 52, where for a hot minute Jim Gordon was like 30 or 40 years old. Which is, that's just not Commissioner Gordon, is it?
No, that's just Captain Gordon or something like that, isn't it?
Captain Gordon, indestructible.
You see, when you said we were covering alternate Batmans, the only thing that sprang to my mind was Alfred in the 1966 series.
Oh, God. I forgot about that.
See, I actually had a completely different version of Alfred as Batman in mind. It was in, I think, one of the more recent comics, the start of Tom King's run. I see that there's a scene where Alfred has, like, sub in for Batman. And you just see him driving around in the Batmobile, like the costume just hanging off him because he's half Bruce's size. And of course, Mick's favourite Batman, Two-Face.
What?
Yeah, this was a storyline called Face the Face. So basically the idea is that Two-Face, Harvey Dent, gets his face fixed.
Oh, that's nice.
It is nice. He turns his life around. Starts helping Batman out.
Oh, yeah. That's the kind of heartwarming backstory that leads to Harvey Dent then winning X Factor.
If by win X Factor you mean Ree messes up his face, goes even more insane, starts dressing in like a weird patchwork version of Batman's outfit and trying to kill him again, then yes.
Well, isn't that what happens to most X Factor winners?
Fair point. Anyway, alternate Batmans is, first up, we have got Terry McGinnis.
Yep, Batman of the future.
Yep, he was introduced in the cartoon show Batman of the Future, or if you're in America, Batman Beyond, which is a much better name. Why make it Batman of the Future?
Because
maybe, you know when they called the first Avengers movie Avengers Assemble so that we didn't get it confused with the 1960s spy series?
Maybe okay, I'm pretty sure Batman Beyond was not a 1960s spy series.
No, but they thought that we poor Brits might get confused with 80s pop sensations Brother Beyond.
That must be it. You've solved it.
So if they went with their original title of Brother of the Future, we could have had Batman Beyond. Because I don't think they would have sold as many singles.
Alternate continuities, what a weird one that would be.
Exactly.
I think Brother of the Future was Marvel's vehicle for reinventing Luke Cage.
But I would read like a sci-fi blaxploitation comic.
Yes, absolutely.
Anyway,
you're welcome,
Terry
Marvel.
McGinnis, he lives in the future. I think it's like the year 2030. And his dad is killed by a gang called the Jokers, with a Z on the end. And that leads to him meeting a now elderly and retired Bruce Wayne, who kind of lets Terry take up the mantle as the brand new Batman. And he even gets a cool future suit. Is the Batman of the future suit like the anti-Azrael Batman's?
Well, I wouldn't be at all surprised if it had some of the Azrael technology in there. But it basically was they basically looked at the Azrael suit and said, why have you got gold on there? Why have you got like bright yellow and gold on there when you're supposed to be the Dark Knight? The clue's in the title.
Yeah. And just like, I really love this costume. It's like really sleek. You've got like just the big red bat symbol.
Yeah.
To make it really striking. And then you've got cool things like jet boots and the wings that just kind of like fold out from the armpits.
Yeah, it's just a wingsuit, isn't it?
Yeah. And also the thing where, like, the mask makes a face, which doesn't actually make any sense if you think about it, but who cares? It looks cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Batman of the Future was a really good show. It was properly dark as well.
It was, but I think the darkest thing from Batman of the Future was Terry McGinnis's origin.
I don't know.
You know, well, I mean,
yeah, it was like eventually revealed that Terry is actually like Bruce's clone. So
that's what I mean. And
the... But also, I mean, I'm talking about, there was a character in one episode who could phase through things, and then his phasing belt malfunctioned, and he ended up just like falling through the earth.
Yep. What I'm talking about, where I think the darkest thing was Terry McGinnis's origins, being a clone. Basically, he wasn't so much the son of Batman as a clone of him, because Amanda Waller decided that the world needed a Batman.
Which, I mean, to be fair, she's probably not wrong.
No. It's not that I disagree with her.
Joe, who does disagree with people?
Who?
Paul Dini. Because my kind of favourite tidbit about Batman, I'm going to call it Batman Beyond because that's the better name, is that like it was originally pitched by Warner Brothers executive as them wanting a more kid-friendly Batman show. Okay, Paul, what if Batman, but with a cool, hip teen lead? And he's like, okay, sure. Also, what if his villain is a man who, like, his skin melts off from radioactivity and he's just a burning skeleton?
Oh, I forgot about... Wasn't it Batman Beyond where Tim Drake basically became the Joker?
Yeah, that is Batman Beyond Return of the Joker. The light-hearted fun film in which we find out that Batman's kid sidekick was brainwashed by the Joker, had a complete breakdown, ended up murdering the Joker, and then lived for years with a microchip in his brain that had like a copy of the Joker's personality that rewrote all his own thoughts.
I want to change my choice of darkest bit from that show.
Yeah, it was probably actually that, wasn't it?
Yes. Oh, wow. Let's move on to some more light-hearted ones. Owlman. Owlman is an alternate version of Batman, isn't he?
Yes. That's the light-hearted and fun Batman from the Earth, where all the Justice League are evil villains and run the Earth as a fascist dictatorship.
Yeah. What do they call the Crime Syndicate or something?
Yep, the Crime Syndicate of America. No, it's okay. It's okay. We'll move on.
The CSA.
Yes, the Child Support Agency. Yeah.
That explains a lot about the last 6 months.
Flashpoint had a really interesting version, alternate version of Batman, didn't
it? Yeah, that was actually the next one on my list. So Flashpoint was basically the event that led to DC's New 52, and in it, Barry Allen, he travels back in time to try and stop the Reverse Flash from killing his mum, saves her, but in the process accidentally rewrites all of history and kind of comes back to find the world's in a bit of a state. Aquaman and Wonder Woman are now like at war and have destroyed most of the planet. I think like they've sunk all of Europe. So Barry goes to his good old friend Batman for help, only to find that Bruce Wayne is dead ever since he was gunned down in an alleyway as a child. And this Batman is actually his dad, Thomas Wayne.
Yep. I like Flashpoint as a story. I think it really works.
I feel like I maybe like the concept more than the execution.
Well, yeah, okay. Execution-wise, it's not great. And it's time travel, which we know is... No one's really got it right, have they?
No, I think that's a very true statement.
But I like the whole point of Flashpoint. You know, it's basically the road to hell paved with good intentions, isn't it?
Yeah. And I like the things with this Batman, like the idea that he funds all his crime fighting by turning like Gotham into a resort town.
Yeah.
Just like casinos everywhere.
And I like Thomas Wayne's version of Batman because it is clearly more about revenge.
Yeah, like it's a fun mix of like this is a Batman who uses lethal force.
Yeah.
A, because he's just like this bitter man who's broken by the death of his son. And also B, he's friggin' 50 years old. He can't be doing no fancy kung fu hand to hand.
I'm gonna jump on top
of Killer Croc and like smash a smoke bomb on him.
Hey there, Mr. Judgy. Some people can be quite spry for the age of 50.
Okay, high kick, Mick.
I mean, I'm
who told you
I'm
my nickname?
I'm not saying he's not got a lot of get up and go.
I'm just saying he got up and went.
Also, what I think is really cool with Flashpoint Batman is that in this universe, the Joker is actually Martha Wayne.
Yes, which just adds to his bitterness, doesn't it?
Yeah, like his son's dead and his wife is now like Gotham's greatest supervillain. All right, shall we round things out with a few Elseworlds?
Yes, yes, yes. Some Elseworlds. Oh, can I just mention, though, that the anarchist Batman in the anarchist Russian Batman, I should say, in
Comrade Batman.
Comrade Batman was great.
Yeah, this is Superman Red Rain.
No, it's Red Sun.
No, yeah, Red Sun. Red Rain is a Batman story that I've got on this list. So, yeah, Superman Red Sun, that is a story where, basically, what if Superman was raised in communist Russia and Batman is just like this weird Russian anarchist?
It's great. Comrade Batman is amazing.
Yeah, like, I love that his costume is like the Batman costume, but also he's wearing an Oshenka. Just with like little pointy ears on top. I want that hat.
It's amazing. Oh.
So yeah, first of all, and actually what was the first ever Elseworlds book? Gotham by Gaslight.
Yes.
Which is written by Brian Augustin with art by Mike Mignola. This is Batman who was like, what if Superman was raised in communist Russia? What if Batman was like raised in the 1800s and also fought Jack the Ripper?
See, the interesting thing about Batman from Gotham by Gaslight, I don't know if it was an actual follow-on, but it was basically the same version of Batman that was in Master of the Future as well.
Yeah, Master of the Future is the sequel to that.
Oh, is it? Excellent.
Yeah. That one's cool, because he fights on a blimp.
Yes. In a top hat, even.
I mean, that's really all I need from fiction.
There was a weird, bizarre one, which you've read, because I've got it. The Blue, the Grey, and the Bat, which was the Old West version of Batman.
Oh, goodness, yeah, I completely forgot about Cowboy Batman.
Yeah, Cowboy Batman was weird. It was basically the Lone Ranger, wasn't it?
Pretty much. Anyway, since we're near the end, can we talk about my favourite alternate Batman?
Which one?
This is Batman, the Doom that came to Gotham. And this is a story, again, Mike Mignola, this time he does the writing, with art by Mick, someone you know, Troy Nixie.
Ah!
And this is a really bad idea. It's basically Batman set in the 1920s and combined with, like, At the Mountains of Madness and the Cthulhu mythos.
Ooh.
It's like, it starts with famous explorer Bruce Wayne coming across in the Arctic, coming across Professor Oswald Cobblepot, right? Like, esteemed professor who seems to have completely lost his mind and is now living with the Penguin, and then kind of goes on to find a cave with a man covered in ice and, like, just radiating snow trying to hack away at an ancient idol. And then it turns out, like, this massive Lovecraftian horror story about, like, Ra's al Ghul trying to raise a great old one to destroy the world. And it also has, like, maybe the best version of Two-Face. Because he starts off as just Harvey Dent, mayor of Gotham, until a mysterious woman, who is actually like a plant that Ra's al Ghul has brought to life, kind of scratches him, and he starts breaking out in a rash. But he says, don't worry, it's just poison ivy.
Wow.
Only it then gets like worse. Yeah, it starts off as just a poison ivy rash, but then just like gets worse and worse, and like just becomes this massive, like, writhing mass of flesh growing off his body, until eventually he turns into a gateway to an alternate dimension. It's really weird and I love it.
I have an interesting alternate version of Batman.
Okay, go ahead.
The Doomsday Batman.
Oh, this is... Yeah, I feel like maybe we should have talked about the fact that DC only very recently had a whole event based around the concept of what if a bunch of evil alternate Batmen appeared.
Was that the metal thing or was that something else?
Yeah, that was Dark Knight's metal, which...
Yeah.
So Mick, I apologise for this, but you know how there's a DC multiverse?
I am aware.
What if there was a dark multiverse which exists under the multiverse?
Yeah.
And is full of Batman who are no good naughty boys.
And all of the Earths are negative Earths. So it's not Earth 1, it's Earth minus 1, or Earth minus 267.
What?
And on those Earths, you have characters like the Batman who laughs.
Yeah, this is the main reason why I didn't really want to talk about Dark Knight's Metal, because I don't like the Batman who laughs.
Yeah,
It's basically like the worst of Batman and the worst of the Joker in one character.
See, I liked the Doomsday version of Batman because it was basically, it was Superman who turned evil. Batman armed himself to the teeth to try and stop him, lost an arm and went to his final resort, which was injecting himself with something to do with Doomsday, as in Doomsday who killed Superman for a little bit. Or put Superman to sleep for a little bit. Let's just say it like that, because that's all it was.
Yeah. But send Superman away on a nice little holiday.
No, he put Superman down for a nap. Doomsday is the nanny, isn't he?
See, prior to tonight's episode, the most I'd been exposed to disturbing images of alternative Batman was 1990s Pepe Marino drawn. I say drawn. Digital Justice.
Oh. That was back when CGI was going to be the future of comics, wasn't it?
That's right.
We're going to get the computers to draw them all. That's going to look... Oh, no.
But I have found an alternative Batman that should exist, even if it doesn't. I'm going to share it with the two of you now, and I urge our listeners to Google this. Batman 1972, or as the article I've posted for you guys calls it, the first evidence of Batsploitation.
The first evidence of Batman of Batsploitation.
Yes.
Oh, is this just like a concept art thing? So this looks really cool.
I'm sorry, but that looks amazing. Seriously.
This is an alternative Batman that doesn't exist, but really should.
I want this Batman. I want this. I mean, I'm sorry, Catwoman looks amazing with the afro.
I know.
Batman's just like the leather jacket and the cigarette hanging out.
We want Batsploitation and we want it now.
Yes.
I'd read this. Well, anyway.
So now Batman
Mick has like taken my hours worth of preparation and casually destroyed it all with one picture.
Hey, one
shall we go for a break?
Yes, one magnificent picture, I have to say.
Hi there, I'm Robert Rankin, and you're listening to the Geek Show. Oh yes.
Have you ever been reading through a stack of comics and thought, maybe I should see what this Arkham Asylum game is all about? Or been playing Marvel vs. Capcom and felt like you were at a real disadvantage since you didn't know who half the characters were? Well, Play Comics is the show for you. I'm Chris, and each episode we take a look at video games based on comic properties and how well they stick to that source material. So whether you know the comics and want to know how all these games work, or you know the games and want to find out where all this craziness came from, go check out Play Comics at playcomics.com or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Hi, and welcome back to part two of 4Panel, in which we like to tell you about things what we have read. Rob.
That was a long pause before you got to me.
I know.
I was thinking, what's going on? Is he going to say my name?
I just had one of those moments where I thought, who's going first? And then I thought, it's a 50-50 guess.
Definitely. Like, in the editing, don't cut out that pause, but just replace it with the countdown music.
Oh, no, we'll get a copyright strike.
Oh, no.
I'm sure I can find
some, like, copyright-friendly, almost the countdown.
Yeah. Right, okay. First up is me, and I'm talking about a manga. It's been a while since we had a manga. We got a couple to go through, but I'm not going to do them all today. Today, I'm just going to do the one. Now, the one that I have is Volume 1 of Grand Blue Fantasy, which isn't actually a manga. It's an anime series, but it isn't actually an anime series. It's a mobile phone game and a browser game by Cygames. So, yeah, it came out originally as a game in 2014, and people have played through the story and know what the story is because it's been quite a popular game.
So this is the manga of the anime of the game.
Yeah. So, wonderful.
Oh my God, we've done it. We've beaten Street Fighter the movie, the video game.
Yes. This is Grand Blue Fantasy, the manga of the anime of the video game. So if someone out there wants to do the manga of Street Fighter 2, the movie, the video game, please do so, because then it can take its rightful crown again. But until then, Grand Blue Fantasy, I think, is the king of just really pointless adaptations that serve no purpose whatsoever. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's illustrated by Kocho, it's got layouts by Makoto Fugetsu, it's created by Cygames, it looks really nice, the artwork's interesting. I mean, the character design has been around for 5 years already. The designs of the dragons and the various other things in here are all pretty solid. We know where they came from. They came from video games. The storyline is solid. It's standard sword and sorcery fantasy type stuff with floating islands and airships and dragons and all sorts of things like that. You have an evil empire who's after a young lady who has the secret power that can control the dragons. And you have Gran, who is a normal orphan boy. Tell me if you've heard this story before. There was an orphan boy. He had something special about him. He went off on a quest to save the world, even though he didn't realize he was doing that.
I don't know. I've only heard that in every single other fantasy property.
Yeah. So this is about as generic a fantasy story as you can get. From video game or book or movie or anime or manga or comic or whatever. It is literally that generic. But you know what? It's still not bad. It's well drawn. The characters are okay. It basically wears its heart on its sleeve. I mean, the clue's in the title. It says Grand Blue Fantasy. It's announcing, I am a fantasy story. I don't care what you say. I'm going to do what I want. You can't tell me what to do. You're not my real author. And I kind of like it because it's got that attitude, or it feels like it has that attitude. But aside from that, it's a common or garden fantasy story. So for most people, they can take it or leave it.
Well, there you go. That seems pretty easy to do.
Yep. What was that, 2.5 minutes, was it?
Yeah, that might be one of our most concise reviews ever. Just, this fantasy manga is a manga that is a fantasy.
Yeah.
It does what it says on the tin.
That's literally it. It's a Ron Seal manga. Although
manga by Ron Seal.
I was going to say...
It does what it says on the tin.
No, Ron Seal the manga would be amazing. It would just be pages and pages of varnish drying on a fence.
I think I reviewed that one last year.
Anyway, Andrew.
Yep. So I have been reading Mind MGMT, the Mind Management Comprehensive Report, 3 of 3, Cognizance Operatives and Their Invisible Influence, including important details regarding your past involvement.
See, I preferred the other
merchant.
Way. Yeah, I preferred the other way you said mind management.
Oh, of mind management.
Mind management.
Yeah, because this is the third omnibus. I still have no idea how you're actually supposed to say the title. So yeah. As I hinted, this is the conclusion to this, once again, following journalist Meru as she tries to uncover the truth behind mind management, a secretive government project designed to breed psychic super soldiers. And in this one, we see Meru, having now discovered that she herself was an ex-mind management agent, working with the few surviving Goodens to stop the Eraser, who wants to bring back mind management and use it to influence world events from afar.
And when you say the Eraser, we're not talking about Arnold, are we?
No, well, we are not quite talking about just big old Arnie Schwartzy.
And we're not talking about that weird DC comic book supervillain who dresses like a pencil.
What?
You know, that villain who dresses like a pencil and has a magic eraser on his head because he rubs people out.
No. No, Rob. Not today.
Okay.
Even
my
that one
life
is too low-hanging. But again, it is worth it for Mick discovering a new character. Because I bet you thought this was the one, didn't you? This was the one we had finally made up.
And what I like is the fact that on the search that I've done, it comes up with the Eraser. And it says that this is a pre-crisis DC comic. Oh no, DC, I think you were in crisis. That is, I mean, what kind of acid trip creates that? I mean, at a distance, in some shots, it looks like a banana.
I mean, you say what kind of acid trip? I feel like you've already sussed the main influence.
Really?
We're doing good deeds here, Andrew. We're helping the aged.
To do what? Have a brain aneurysm?
Fine. Once your old mind is destroyed, your third eye will open and you can finally understand the real truth.
You see,
the truth
thing
of
is,
mind management.
The longer I do this podcast, the more digital justice makes sense.
So if it was mind management, digital justice would actually have some kind of like hidden secret meanings, like encoded into the words that only you could see.
Oh God, now you said it, and now, now I'm thinking, should I check it again?
You can get a Lego minifigure eraser.
See, I'm torn, because I want to talk more about mind management, but I'm also fascinated by Mick's just complete breakdown.
The two kind of go together as well, don't they?
This is your fault, Rob. You mentioned eraser.
Well, technically I mentioned eraser, and then Rob mentioned a different eraser.
Yeah. You mentioned eraser in context of what you were talking about, and then Rob derailed it, and then me.
Luckily, none of us talked about the Marvel character Eraser.
Oh, whoa, no!
I forgot about him.
It's okay, he's not a rubber, he's just an alien who can wipe you away to an extra dimension.
Yeah, the Marvel version of Eraser is good at wiping. Anyway, mind management, Andrew.
Mind management! So yeah, this is just a nice, big, meaty omnibus full of, like, answers and catharsis. Just especially after, like, issues and issues of, like, plot twists and confusion and, like, you know, threads that go in one direction and then another direction. It's just really nice to have, like, everything coming together. And again, it's one of those things where I'm always surprised with a book like this. Just how much of, like, the seemingly random stuff peppered throughout actually ends up like playing a big role in the conclusion.
That's a sign of a good writer, though, isn't it?
It is. And just there's things that, like, that you take for granted as just part of the book that actually end up being like proper story details. Like, Rob, you've read Man and Manage, haven't you?
Yeah.
So you know how it's in the margins there's always like notes from the Mind Management Field Guide.
Yeah.
So it turns out that's not just like an artistic thing. It's actually a representation of the idea that all mind management agents, they have the field guide like unconsciously embedded in their minds. And there's a bit where like Meru gets hers unlocked and you just see the text start to like seep from the margins into the like panel itself, which is just a really neat effect.
That sounds really cool. Because I thought it was just like little doodles and stuff like that. You know, when you get some books where they do like the line paper, it's supposed to be a diary and they got little doodles and stuff like that, just in the margins and in, you know, the bottom and top, in the header and footer and stuff like that. Yeah. I thought it was that.
Yeah. And I think that's very deliberately done.
This is some Inception level comic book making.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's very much like kind of the point of the book, isn't it? That it's like wheels within wheels. Things you thought were just like meaningless ancillary details are actually coded messages. This is like the big fighty action book. So you get lots of cool things. Like there's a really cool bit where Meru, so it's established earlier in the series that her power is she can kind of nullify other people's powers. Except this like takes it even further. And so that's like kind of making this idea that it's about belief, like really kind of pulls into the idea that all people's abilities, like, you know, getting rid of illness by just focusing the mind to reject it. That's all nonsense pseudoscience.
Wow.
And like Meru is the one who can say, yeah, but what, you can't actually do that, can you? And like, basically, as soon as like an agent loses the belief in their own powers, they can't do the thing anymore.
See, the weird thing is, I get it. I totally get it. It's something that I said a long time ago to a friend of mine. I said, ignorance is probably the world's greatest superpower, because if someone doesn't know that they can't pick themselves up by the scruff of the neck, then they'll probably go ahead and do it, because the brain is weird like that.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you can do something if you believe you can do it.
Yeah.
But as soon as someone introduces that kernel of doubt, you're dunzos. Also, there's a really visually great bit where there's like the final fight inside Mind Management headquarters. But it like goes through basically all the different characters' perceptions. That's kind of a bit like, you know, in X-Men, when like they would have a battle on the psychic plane.
Yeah.
It's basically like that, where just, you know, like it can shift from the inside of a building, like the top of a mountain, to outer space. And that just makes for a really cool finale. Yeah, it's more good. Mind Management, good book. Bye, read.
Well, that sounded like a searing recommendation there.
Yep, that's all it was, a searing recommendation. Definitely wasn't a carefully planned series of secret code words designed to be heard by one specific person whose brain has now clicked to activate the secret commands embedded in there many years ago.
Okay. Hold on. Why have I just clicked buy it now on a copy of Mind MGMT? Wow.
It was all real.
Yeah.
Now it's time for you to talk about Mind MGMT.
Oh, that'll be difficult. Because I've only just clicked buy it now. I mean, you know, certain online retailers are good, but they ain't that good.
Well, Mick, you may have thought today you were covering the series Outworld Blues. Is that what it was called?
Offworld Blues.
But if you look at the copy of the book in your hands...
It says Offworld Blues.
Oh. I knew you were going to do that, Mick.
So, yeah, this is Offworld Blues, described as a riveting galactic adventure brought to life by the writer J.D. Morvan, who's done Wolverine and Bramble, and artist Bakam.
Wait, hold on. Are those two separate series, or is there a book called Wolverine and Bramble?
It says Wolverine, comma Bramble, so I'm assuming two separate series. Wolverine and Bramble, it sounds like a Marvel detective agency.
No, not
set
a Marvel.
Set in a retirement village.
I was about to say, it sounds like an Agatha Christie detective agency that Marvel got their hands on.
And the art is by Bakan, who did Doom Patrol, Silver Age.
Ooh.
And basically, it tells the story of an intergalactic peacekeeping force who have arrested a terrorist who's been stirring up trouble with our alien neighbor. And then it gets a bit confusing because some of it is set now, which is actually in the future, in like the 30th century. And some of it is set in the past, which is like sort of 20, 30 years earlier. But anyway, it starts off with the firing squad of this terrorist called Nerta Amerli. And they done shoot him dead because he's done bad things.
And then that sounds like a nice, concise story.
Yeah. And then we cut to now, which is the future. And we have some explosions happening on a ship. And some clones waking up to discover that they're in the middle of an emergency situation. Now, the weird thing about Offworld Blues is it is, in fact, a riveting galactic adventure. But more importantly, it's a riveting galactic soap opera, really. Because there are so many plot lines going on within it that sometimes it gets a bit difficult to remember what's going on where. And the art style is deceptive because it reminds me of a slightly more textured version of the artwork in stuff like Call of Cthulhu. It's still that sort of cartoony style. But then there's the shading on it is more subtle. But that belies the complexity of the narrative that's going on underneath. And it's, you know, it's got all the hallmarks of an adventure in a corrupt colonial regime. There's the difficulties of cloning systems and uploading personalities into clones and things like that. So it's a really good sci-fi adventure. It's a really good exploration of the us versus them element of colonialism and imperialism.
Yeah.
It's a good exploration of people trying to make their way of living work within the wider system that they've got. And there are some genuinely touching moments as well, especially around the adoption of an alien baby. And although it can be confusing in places, it's a really good read. I really enjoyed it. And I'm always a bit wary when we get a weighty tome from Humanoids to review.
Yeah.
Because we've been bitten before by them. But this one, no, I really, really, really enjoyed it. Off-World Blues, I think it collects a two-volume piece that was originally published in the 90s. And it, do you know what it tells me? It tells me that not all 90s comics were bad.
Cool.
Just the ones you two read.
Yeah, pretty much.
So I have a question, Mick. How does it work as a Star Wars prequel?
Well, it doesn't.
But it could, couldn't it? Because you've got the clones, you've got the colonialism and the imperialism, you've got...
Yeah, but what you've actually got here is a plot.
That's what I mean.
So it doesn't work as a Star Wars prequel.
But could it? Could it replace things like The Phantom Menace and stuff like
no,
that?
No, because the other thing is it's quite well written.
Damn Rob, it. I know what you're doing, Rob. You're trying to stall so you don't have to talk about the sexy sex men.
Yeah, I am. Oh, I guess I'm going to have to. Age of X-Men, Marvelous X-Men. Why are you making me do
this? No one's making you do this, but you know the rules. You read it, you review it.
And you have X-Men, who's basically Shaman Jesus, because that's what he is.
In a bathrobe.
Yeah, Shaman Jesus in a bathrobe. This is...
Hold on, but doesn't that basically make him the dude?
Yeah, he is basically the dude. Good spot there, Mick. He is
but
quite
the dude,
literally.
If he decided no one in the world was allowed to be frisky anymore.
Yeah, except for him. So this collects Age of X-Men, The Marvelous X-Men issues 1-5, and Age of X-Men Alpha and Omega. And it's written by people who I shall name in a couple of seconds. Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler. Age of X-Men Alpha 1 is got art by Ramon Rosanas with colours by Triona Farrell and letters by VC's Clayton Cowles. The Marvelous X-Men is got art by Marco Fela with colours by Matt Miller and letters by VC's Joe Caramagna. And Age of X-Men Omega is got art by Simone Buonfantino, colours by Triona Farrell and letters by VC's Clayton Cowles. And so... Yes, what you have then is the first story, which is The Age of X-Men Alpha, where it introduces you to the perfect world that Charles Xavier dreamed of, where mutants and humans live side by side in peace, and people use their powers freely, and whenever a new mutant awakens who may be a threat, they send in the X-Men who help them calm down, and they can control the powers, and yada yada yada. Everything is peaceful in 1950s America, because that's basically what it is. The only thing that isn't peaceful is that Will Smith song, Getting Jiggy With It, would obviously have him in a firing squad or something like that, or facing a firing squad. So you have the X-Men, who are Nature Girl, Colossus, Storm, X-23, who looks a lot like Negasonic Teenage Warhead from the Deadpool movies, only with claws, Nightcrawler, Magneto, X-Man, or the dude, as we'll call him. And the cover of this has Jean Grey looking like an angry Rachel from Friends.
Rachel looked like an angry Rachel from Friends a lot of the time as well.
Exactly. So, anyway, this presents initially an idyllic world where mutants are accepted freely, but there is a problem because Lucas, is it, who is part of the team originally... Him and Jean get jiggy, but they're not supposed to get jiggy. And so Lucas is arrested. And I can find out more about what happens to him if I read Prisoner of X, which I really am not going to. So we'll leave that to
one. Actually, that one's quite good.
So anyway, after he's gone, his house is empty because he's been taken by the secret people, the secret police who are all wearing black, and Bobby or Iceman is part of their group, along with other people, including Lass, who has weird fingers that basically go in your ears and read your mind. So, yeah. Moving on, they have Xavier Day and they have various other holidays, and Storm and Jean Grey and everyone else, they're all like, yay, we are the X-Men, we can do whatever we want. But then things start falling apart because Apocalypse turns up. But Apocalypse, this time round, is preaching love and peace. Love and peace. And getting jiggy. He wants people to get jiggy because he is supposed to be the bad man. He is the yin to this world's yang. He is the omega to this world's alpha. He represents the bad. And so, you know, they have to resist the bad, but people can't resist the bad. People can resist everything but temptation. And Apocalypse is trimmed down a lot for this, but that's also down to X-Man, who has been playing around with reality for a bit. Obviously, things continue to fall apart, and then you come to the conclusion, which, I'll admit, was kind of dull. I've got to be honest, as a look at what a possible idyllic world with the perfect X-Men in there and everything like that, as far as that goes, I preferred Magneto's version, because this version here, it's, you know, when you have those shows where they show this really idyllic lifestyle, this really perfect town with all the people who are so nice to each other, and they always greet each other politely, and everybody's nice to each other, and it's almost toothachingly perfect.
Yeah, well, what's the whole Stepford Cuckoos thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Stepford Wives, Stepford Cuckoos are an X-Men thing. God damn it, comics you have.
No, you were thinking of the Midwich Cuckoos.
No, I was thinking of the Stepford Wives.
Stepford Wives and Midwich also Cuckoos.
The X-Men characters, the Stepford Cuckoos.
Yeah, but Stepford Wives...
It's that they are so perfect that it's like very unsettling and things clearly wrong.
Yeah, it's the Uncanny Valley thing. You just look at it and you go, there's something not right here. And obviously there is something not right there. Everybody's being controlled and they've forgotten their history. They've forgotten what basically makes them who they are. What was the phrasing that Rob used for it? Who's that lass who goes around doing all the documentaries, who's not very good at making documentaries?
What's Stacey Dooley?
Yeah, the vacant eyes of Stacey Dooley, that's what it looks like. That's how Rob describes it. And I totally
Stacey Dooley investigates the age of X-Men.
I would watch that episode just to see what she thinks of this whole. I mean, it is very, very puritanical. You cannot involve yourself in any of these shenanigans. If you are dating a woman, you must stay at least 50 feet apart. The fact that they had this bizarre idea that the whole problem with the X-Men, the biggest problem with the X-Men, the one that caused all of their grief and all of their pain, wasn't the fact that they weren't accepted by the world, but the fact that they were horny as hell. I'm sorry, it's laughable.
I mean, I don't know. I think if you look at a lot of X-Men stories...
No, I understand.
The problem is that they're just too dang horny.
The thing is, I understand how people could come to that conclusion, but that just... You made me read this, and it's kind of tragic how hilarious it is when you read it. And someone's written this in all seriousness. There's some amazing moments in this.
One of them when Apocalypse yells out the line, and I quote verbatim, "Charles Xavier knew the power of our sensuality."
Yeah, that was one cool bit. But there's other bits. There's a prison riot going on, and who's that pink guy with the skull and the eyeballs who's Wolverine's...
Oh, Blob Herman.
Yeah, Blob Herman. He's in the prison riot. Sorry?
Glob.
Oh, sorry, Glob Herman.
With a G.
Yeah. So he's in the prison because, obviously, he's an unsightly person, so he has to be locked away. But he's just watching TV.
He's too naked for this new world, Rob. That's his problem.
Yeah. So he's in the prison, and there's a riot going on around him, and there's guards and prisoners fighting each other and tearing each other apart. But Glob is sitting there watching TV. And there's an amazing scene of just the guards trying to hit Glob and not doing any damage to him whatsoever. He's still sat there watching TV. He's like, you know, he doesn't even know that they're hitting him.
Bless him. I'd say bless his cotton socks, but he doesn't wear cotton socks. So yeah. I guess they just get covered in, like, weird skeleton wasps.
Yeah, I mean, there's another one who basically looks like he's made of rocks, who's standing there, and he's basically just trying to do his job as a prisoner. He's cleaning trays and bussing trays and stuff like that. One of the guards runs over to punch him and breaks his wrist on a guy who's basically made of rocks.
That's Rock Slide. His yep. mutant power is that he's made of rocks.
So who'd win in the fight between him and the Thing? One's made of bricks, the other's made of rocks.
So in theory, the Thing probably wins like a straight up fight. But also Rockstar is literally, he is made of rocks. He's like more like Sandman than the Thing.
Ah, I see.
So if you smash him apart, he just makes himself a big old new rock body.
Oh, what if he meets Cog? Cog might think he's his distant cousin or something like that.
Maybe he is.
That would be interesting. Rock sliding Cog.
My God, that's a detective agency to rival even Wolverine and Bramble.
Exactly.
Wolverine and Bramble.
Oh, can you imagine if the both of them got the same case? I can see Cog and Wolverine getting on like a house on fire. If anyone's ever been in a burning house, you know exactly what I mean. I think that's us done for the day, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think I'm just done. I think the eraser has killed me.
I mean, to be fair to you, Rob, that review was kind of a rambling, mostly incoherent mess that, you know, had a few ideas in it that sort of just petered out. Which makes it perfect for Age of X-Men.
I was about to say, that's the only way you can review Age of X-Men. Oh, I'm just going to clue you guys in, right? I had a choice between Age of X-Men and Cosmic Ghost Rider Destroys Marvel History. And you know what was the easiest one to do was Age of X-Men. I'm just going to leave that there.
And on that grim portent for the future.
Yeah. If you want to catch any of our other episodes, you'll find them all on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk. Or you can find them on whichever podcast provider you are using. We are on all of the best ones, so, you know, do check us out. You'll also find on our website, our Patreon, and also video game reviews and movie reviews and all of the other shows that make up the Geek Show Network. If you want to get in touch with us for any reason, or you are interested in getting involved in what we do, then you can contact us on studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. And that's it from us for this week. We'll be back next week. Until then, I have been Rob.
Who am I? I'm Andrew.
And I've been Mick, I think.
And we will
that
see...
That man voice hurts.
We will see you all later.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye now.